jazz.
Busted.
We ready?
I'm ready. Are you ready?
I don't know. I don't know if I can be sassy enough.
You be sassy and I'll be divine.
All right.
I can be sassy and you can be divine.
I don't know. Welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 167. We're going to devote this one to Sarah Vaughn, so we're both dressed just like her.
Really? Okay.
The wig's a little uncomfortable. I'm also fighting a really wicked cold. It's like half my throat. Something bad happened to it in the night.
You might actually be able to hit some of Sarah's lower notes in her later career then.
Oh, no. She is so far out of my range. Yeah, she developed into an amazing baritone bass as a older singer. So, yeah, this is a podcast at my suggestion focused on one of our great jazz vocalists. And I don't know about you, I felt like I really had to kind of bore down and dig into her stuff because while I've accumulated a fair amount legally and illegally over the years, a lot of her stuff I kind of bounced off of. I mean, the more commercial stuff, it's kind of like, you know, they brought this race car and they're driving it to the mall.
Yeah.
And it's like, why? So I think we did a pretty good job of picking stuff that is not like that, that's Sarah at her best. Do you want me to run down that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so we're going to talk about her in general, of course, and I'm not sure when we're going to start digging into the recordings specifically, but the ones we're looking at, four early tracks that she did on the Guild label in 1945 with Charlie Parker, and then the first album we're doing is with Clifford Brown, MRC, from 1954, and I'm going to commit blasphemy concerning that album, so brace yourselves.
Okay.
And then I asked to do, we were looking at a roulette best of, but then I realized I had like a couple random volumes of the complete roulette that came out on a Mosaic a few years back. I did not own that, but somehow ran across a couple of them. And one of them paired two duet albums or trio albums, however you want to say it, Sarah with a guitarist and a bass player. So the first was After Hours from 1961 on roulette, and the second was Sarah Plus Two from 1962 on roulette. Right. Before that, chronologically, which I've screwed up here, a live album she did for the Mercury label at Mr. Kelly's from 1957. I think that was officially released on MRC, the subsidiary of Mercury that released jazz-related recordings. And then finally, we're jumping ahead in time to 1979's Copacabana on Pablo. Norman Granz's label gave her kind of a late career boost, and she recorded a number of fine recordings on that label in the 70s.
Yeah.
So that's what we're looking at.
And we could talk about, we could talk about her last album as well, Brazilian Romance, if you want.
Yeah, I ran across Brazilian Romance at a used record store, I'd say 2 or 3 years back, a fairly clean copy. And I think the main thing to say about it is, you know, towards the end there, she still was a pretty good singer. You know, she lose her voice. And apparently she drank and smoked and did cocaine, so... So she dies fairly young. She is born 1924, so she is slightly younger than Billie Holiday, born 1915, or Ella Fitzgerald, born 1917. And Billie, Ella, and Sarah are generally considered the three, you know, the holy trinity of female jazz vocalists.
They are, you know, I was thinking about this. We've talked about this before. The Mount Rushmore of the female jazz singers, there's no question. It's Ella, Billie, and Sarah. And then, you know, who's the Teddy Roosevelt on Mount Rushmore, you know, among female jazz singers? I'm going to nominate Bessie Smith.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, she's nothing as nearly as talented as the other three, but is an iconic, important figure. But those three are really are the, they are the big three. You just have to conjure with them.
Right. And we talked about the difficulty in certain ways of figuring out who the men in that canon would be on, way back on episode 15 when we discussed Mel Torme, Kurt Elling, Gregory Porter, and Kevin Mahogany. Obviously, many of those later figures. And of course, many, many fine female vocalists in that field. It's just in terms of the preeminent ones that everybody kind of agrees on were great. Those are the three names that tend to pop up.
Yeah, there's not, you know, for the men, there's not an equivalent set of guys who you would go head and shoulders.
Right.
You know, I mean, there are great technicians and there are great singers and there are great interpreters, but there aren't those figures who you would get a consensus on. You hear people maybe pitch Sinatra, maybe pitch Torme, but they just don't have that, the stature of these three women. If you'd asked Frank Sinatra who he admired, like, he'll tell you, you know.
Right. Oh, yeah.
It's Ella, you know. He's very clear about, like, who his hero is. It's not any male singer.
And he also cites Sarah Vaughan. He says that listening to her sing makes him want to cut himself with a rusty razor blade.
Yes.
So I was like, okay.
Right. Yeah, so yeah. But so we should talk just a little bit, I guess, at the beginning about how one goes about distinguishing the three of these great singers from one another. You know, Billie obviously is the one who sounds in some ways the most distinct, in part because she just isn't as a pure voice. She isn't in the same league with the other two, but as an interpreter and as a musician, she's extraordinary. But Ella and Sarah have the better voices, and arguably Sarah has the greatest voice of all.
Yeah, thinking about it, it's Billie, of course, is perhaps the most emotionally striking.
Yeah.
And one thing that occurred to me as we were looking into Sarah is that both Fitzgerald and Holiday have had well-curated, well-preserved canons. I mean, their music is available. It's thoroughly documented. I don't know that you could run across all of Ella Fitzgerald's pre-Verve recordings, probably because no one wants to hear them all.
Right.
But Verve, as a kind of a keeper of her reputation, extensively documented her, and most of that extensive documentation is available. And
yeah.
Then Billie, who did not have as long a career, you know, she's only on three labels, really. The Commodore starts off on Columbia and its related labels, ends up on Verve. And, you know, everything she ever did is in print all the time.
Right.
Not the case with Sarah. And yeah, Sarah, is, you know, I wonder, I think if you're looking for just pure nimbleness, flexibility, you know, maybe Fitzgerald's in the running. But if you're talking about like richness of tone, power, sheer range, you know, an almost operatic gift as a voice.
Right.
Sarah's probably going to be the one. I think it's Tormé that said after she died that she had the single best vocal instrument of any singer working in the popular field. So, you know, Mel's enough of a connoisseur. He's not going to argue that she was necessarily as good as every opera singer who ever lived. But in terms of popular singers, his argument is she had the best instrument. She was just the most gifted.
And there was you don't have to go very far in the internet to find people who will say with, you know, a minimum of training, she could have easily had a major career her voice is that good. She could have been like a classically trained singer. The raw instrument is that good, but that makes it sound like it's not actually like she's this raw, you know, she's actually extraordinarily polished and just supreme control virtually all of the time. I can't think of a single Sarah Vaughan recording where I think, golly, that one got away from her.
Right. You know?
Whereas I can think of a whole pile of Billie Holiday recordings where I'm like, ooh, well, golly, that wasn't a good day. Or plenty of Ella Fitzgerald recordings that I just think, well, that's just a little too self-indulgent, you know, just went a little too far. I never think of Sarah's voice as self-indulgent. And for me, you know, we'll talk about this, but, you know, the late recordings are masterpieces of tastefulness and tact.
Accuse her of her oratorio, in a sense, was Send in the Clouds, Sarah Vaughan's, and her signature piece. And, you know, people would say that some performances of that got a bit rococo, got a bit self-indulgent. But yeah, she's certainly, compared to most opera singers, and I'm glad she did not pursue opera, not that I've got anything against opera, but she probably had better harmonic understanding than I'd say most, I'm guessing, singers like that, because she played piano, she knew harmony, she grew up with the Beboppers. The recordings we're looking at, the very early ones, were done with Charlie Parker in the group. You know, she really understood the theory and underpinning of music as well as being able to execute it at a really superior level. So that enabled her to improvise and kind of modify melodies in a very flexible way because, you know, she knew what she was doing. She knew how to go out without getting lost or getting atonal or just, you know, making a mess of things. And occasionally she'd correct her pianist who didn't always appreciate it. But, you know, right. She said, no, play it this way. You know, they're like, yeah. Had a bit of a reputation as a diva towards the end. And we'll talk about that a little bit. But again, it kind of fits that profile of just a really unbelievably talented vocalist. And certainly I think the one with the thickest, richest, most powerful voice of the three. Just it's just itself. Just as a the sound itself is really rich and multi-layered and kind of envelops you.
Yeah, you know, the early recordings, the transition to the upper reaches of her range are just fucking flawless. And then when she's old, the burnished tone in the lower range never sounds overripe. I mean, just she just has an amazing voice. And as she aged, she was in enormous control of that instrument, like knew what she was doing and really had an ability to maximize her talent. Didn't always pick the best material, but
yes, that is an issue, and that comes up on a couple of these recordings. Yeah, I did get a chance a year back, and then I skimmed it again more recently to read Queen of Bebop, The Musical Lives of Sarah Vaughan by Elaine Hayes. It's from 2017. If you really want to explore, especially the biography, there is some analysis of what she's up to, and there's a certain amount of cultural studies stuff going on in this book. I'm talking about the kind of gender and racial roles that people were comfortable and not comfortable with Sarah being in, and talks a lot about her personal life as well as her career. I think at times it gets too much into the trees and it kind of loses sight of the forest. She'll really get into microscopic detail about certain gigs, and I'm not sure she ever quite sits down and thinks through why Vaughn, who's this incredibly gifted singer, never becomes as popular as, say, Ella Fitzgerald. You know, she's right. Not, she's more, I remember years ago, a professor we both knew very well from our college years, who's now departed, had a jazz collection, and kind of, he knew we were interested in jazz, and he told me, well, you're not really ready for Sarah Vaughan yet. I'm not going to give you Sarah Vaughan. And there is a sense that she's more of a connoisseur's favorite. She certainly had some popular hits, but some people found her harder to get into than Ella Fitzgerald. And as I said before, I think one reason is this material. She worked for a lot of different labels, and she didn't really have a single champion of her work. Probably recorded most extensively for Mercury MRC, but while they released many, many decades ago now, these complete boxes of everything she did, those are long out of print. And there, you know, there's not, it's weird. I was thinking, well, surely the Europeans, now that these things are out of copyright, have come up with their bootleg versions. And it's like, no, you know, some swaths
so
of her
Europeans
career out there.
We know you're all listening to us. Yeah. Get on that shit.
But she works for, you know, Musicraft and then Columbia, and of course suffers with Mitch Miller.
Yeah.
The oboist, who was kind of the inventor of stupid, crude populist music with special effects in it, and just had utter contempt for the audience of the music he was selling, really only cared about the money the label would make on it. Did not appreciate him much, and then went to Mercury MRC, and then Mercury, she could record pop for Mercury and then jazz for MRC. Briefly went to Roulette, some fine records there, went back to Mercury, and then towards the end is on Pablo, Norman Grant's second or third label, I can't quite remember, but he comes back out of retirement after selling off Verve and kind of records the same people he liked back in the 40s and the 50s and 60s, right. But older. And in Vaughn's case, really at her peak in a certain way, though I think some people have a little twinge of gender trouble when they hear her singing that low and they don't like it as much as when she was more girly. She's like, she's still great, but she is now a baritone, so cope with the dudes. So anyway, there's no one caretaker of her legacy, and I maybe that's the reason. Maybe it's just because she was so prolific and some of it's not great. Maybe it's because she was a little bit more of a connoisseur's delight, but you don't have that kind of really extensive archival record of what she did in the way that Fitzgerald has and the way that Holiday has, which, you know, as I listen to this stuff, it's kind of amazing to me. You feel like, why isn't at least everything she did on MRC easily available and cheaply available? Why isn't everything she did on Roulette in a simple box that's, I don't know, or, you know, something you could actually purchase? It just is odd because this is really high-level stuff.
Yeah.
Well, any other thoughts before we kind of start digging into the music?
Let's dive in. You're gonna be a better digger than I am because it's the last 2 weeks of courses here for me, so I'm distracted. But you dig and I'll admire or I'll help. You'd be the primary digger this week.
Okay. You know, and it's weird in a sense because, as I said, this is, I think that it's helpful to have some recommendations because she did record so much. There are compilations out there. It just, you know, if you run across one of the complete, you know, Mercury, I think, released 4 box sets of her stuff, you're going to run into stuff that just is not very compelling. And so, as I said, there is no single kind of source for what's the greatest of Sarah. You have to kind of dig for it. Thank you.
feeling so sad. I long to try something I've never had.
I just suggested we listen to four early tracks that you did with Charlie Parker on Guild. I don't know that I've got a lot to say with them. I remember Lover Man being, you know, an early favorite for me. One, of course, you get a little Charlie, which is nice. This is 45, so she's pretty young. And here, even though she was known as somebody who'd play with the Bebop Boys and scat and would improvise and was as tough as any guy, it's really pretty straightforward torch singing, and I think effective. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I agree. The one of these cuts that has always seemed iconic to me, I mean, so Loverman is terrific. I don't know that that's the gold standard of that recording. I can think of other recordings that are very good, you know. I mean, it's way up there. It's really good. But her recording of Mean to Me is kind of like burned in my brain.
Must you be mean to me? Gee, honey, it seems to me you love to see me crying. I don't know why I stay home. Each night when you say you phone, you don't, then I'm left alone, singing the blues and crying.
And there are other people who sing that, but that's the one that I always think of. Her version of that is, I think, really strong. I don't know why. It's just, for me, kind of the iconic version of that song. She has this kind of weird way of sliding around notes that sounds almost flippant or casual, but it's not. You know, it's like, mean to me. You know, you know, it sounds like she's just kind of, like, you know, with bubblegum in her mouth, kind of goofing it. But in fact, it's really supremely well controlled, which is kind of a gift, it seems to me, to have this almost, she makes what she does there seem pretty casual and offhand and kind of slurry, and it's sulky. She sings Mean to Me the way it should be sung, as a kind of a sulky song, you know. And I believe her. And that's a pretty good interpretation. If you have that much of a voice, you know, you have to find a way to put this song across where it sounds like someone's being mean to you and you're, you know, sulking and resentful. And I've always been convinced by her version. It's the one that's always stuck in my head. And it's not that other people's versions are bad. It's just, this is the kind of...
Right, yeah, she kind of owns it,
Yeah, it's the one I think of. I don't know, I really like her version of this. So, yeah, I agree with you. Loverman is important and iconic, but Mean to Me is the winner here, as far as I'm concerned, out of these four.
Yeah, I'd say that if you're less familiar with jazz vocals or you don't know much about Vaughn, but you are a jazz fan, this might be a way to kind of ease into getting to know her. Hopefully Charlie Parker is a familiar reference point. If not, no problem. But, you know, you might want to listen to him at some point.
Yeah.
And Vaughn is... while she is putting her spin on it and already showing that she's got a great instrument, et cetera, you know, this is pretty straightforward singing, and I think it's pretty emotionally effective. You know, there are times when Vaughn's singing when it is more about sound than sense.
You're feeling, you know, that she sometimes doesn't interpret. You feel like sometimes she's just going through the motions. She and Fitzgerald both had this problem with some of the material they chose. You never had, I can't think of Billie Holiday languishing in shit material that often.
Well, at least when she does, she transforms. I mean, she has a lot of bad songs to sing, but her personality is infused in everything she does. So,
she's all interpretation. Yeah. Sometimes it feels sometimes like Sarah and Ella had material that, while their vocal gifts wouldn't allow them to phone it in, emotionally they phoned it in.
Yeah, well, and you know, I read somewhere a description that Ella Fitzgerald always sang like she was looking for her lipstick in her purse at the same time. I don't think that's true.
I don't think that's true either.
But, you know,
it is funny.
It is funny. And she is a lighter singer, somebody who is... Well, you know, this came up. Another thing I ran across was someone discussing, apparently Rolling Stone ran articles on the 100 greatest guitarists and the 100 greatest vocalists. And the upshot of this discussion was that those lists were moronic, both in terms of, you know, it's completely subjective, and second, in terms of, it had nothing to do with vocalists as singers. It had to do with people whose music I liked. And, you know, so Bob Dylan is up near the top, and it's like, no. I mean, you're talking about him as a singer, you're on crack. He's just, I don't care. Anyway, so it's what do you value? I mean, I think if you're coming from the pop side, a lot of times it's sheerly about quote unquote authenticity or emotional impact. You aren't listening to whether or not the person can quote unquote sing. You know, you're right. Not worried about the instrument. And, you know, with
Billie's going to win that contest every
absolutely,
time.
She does. And of course, in a sense, what she's doing, she recasts melodies, I love her work, her. Really, even her Bago Tricks is much smaller. You know, there's a few things she tends to do over and over again, and it's all infused with, again, that inescapable personality and sincerity and power. And of course, she's got a tiny range, comparatively speaking, etc. She's got great diction. I mean, none of these singers fail to kind of articulate what they're singing, which a lot of singers do. But Sarah Vaughan, it's like if you were a living chocolate fountain, sometimes you're like, it overcomes. He's like, fuck, man, I'm a living chocolate fountain. That's pretty fucking awesome. I taste delicious. And so I think sometimes it's literally just like her voice is more fascinating to her than what she's singing. And you can't blame her. I mean, she's a, you know.
It's true. You could on any of these recordings just not pay attention to the words and just listen to the sounds and be blown away.
Oh, yeah. Just gorgeous. And many things that she sings are, in fact, you know, the version I heard, which was one of the better ones, I guess, of her doing Send of the Clowns, it's like, my God, you know, she is thinking really hard about what those lyrics are about.
Yes.
She is ornamenting them to the nines and showing off this incredible voice and going all over the place with it, but there's a huge reserve of emotional commitment to that particular song. Some of the stuff she sings is crap, and that's just, you know, you can't do that with. But yeah, these early sides, they're not going to show you why she's one of the greatest vocalists of all time, but nice introduction, and I just enjoy them. You know, they're just direct, likable performances with one of the greatest musicians of all time.
And, you know, you can see why she played well with the boys. So did Ella. And you can see why both of them, Norman Granz's long-running Jazz at the Philharmonic series, has tons of cuts with both of them goofing off with famous players. She's a fella. She kind of fits in, and she fits in really well. Who's on those recordings with Charlie, by the way? Who else is in that on those? Do you know?
That's the one I don't. There is a great discography of hers. God, who was a tenor player? I mean, the one that...
Yeah, I was wondering that, actually.
So Michael Minn, M-I-N-N, at michaelminn.net, has various discographies, and he's got a very thorough one of Sarah Vaughan. So the Guild label, the session, the tracks are Lover Man, What More Can a Woman Do, Mean to Me, I'd Rather Have a Memory Than a Dream. Flip Phillips is on tenor, Dizzy Gillespie on trumpet, Charlie Parker on alto, Nate Jaffe on piano, Curly Russell bass, Max Roach drums.
So a lot of those guys are all guys who appear on the Jazz at the Philharmonic. Those are all stalwarts of Norman Granz's JATP series.
And she was, you know, before she goes out as a single, she travels with like Billy Eckstine's band.
Right.
And, you know, there's this chilling discussion of supposedly he told her at one point, you know, you don't have to sleep with every member of the band. And, you know, just not that she was slutting around, but like that she felt like there were, you know, I don't know. We do not go into detail. I don't know the background, whether they were, you know, it's just, you can imagine a very young woman with this group of guys going place to place in a highly segregated society and the kinds of pressures that would expose you to.
And she's young. I mean, she's young when she's out with these guys. She's a teenager when she first hits.
Very shy, raised by religious parents, and originally critiqued for her homeliness. I guess she had like a gap in her front teeth.
Right.
They had bad fashion sense, and they clean. You know, because I think their glamour shots of her as a young woman. I think she's gorgeous. I don't. You know.
Yeah. One of her manager husbands had her teeth fixed.
Right.
And did the the whole wardrobe thing for her, all that stuff.
And this is not, you know, her life is not documented the way Billie Holiday's was.
Right.
But she goes through a succession, it's maybe a little bit more self-inflicted, of husband managers, to the extent that when a well-meaning guy said, you know, I can manage you, she looked at him as like, but you're already married.
Right.
Like, well, yeah, I So, and this just tended not to work. She tended to get guys that were abusive at one level or another, not competent. You know, that she, for a while, she was dating a trumpet player that basically scared off the incredibly accomplished members of her trio by trying to interfere with them. And, you know, so that was kind of the pattern of her life, unlucky in love. I don't think to the extent maybe that Billie Holiday suffered, but, you know, she did suffer exploitation and abuse and unhappiness in her personal life. But yeah, she always worked with musicians. They respected her. She respected them. And, you know, her next session we're going to talk about is famous because of the caliber of musicians on it.
Yeah.
What I always hear when you sigh. Never in my word land could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel. Have you ever heard two turtle doves, bill and coo, when they love? That's the kind of magic music we make with our lips when we kiss.
This is the MRC session with Clifford Brown, sometimes called Sarah Vaughan. This is from 1954. So Clifford Brown's on trumpet on this one, Paul Quinchett on tenor sax, Herbie Mann on flute, Jimmy Jones piano, and he played with her extensively, Joe Benjamin bass, and Roy Haynes on drums. So, you know, I think that was her trio, that, and she frequently would tour with the jazz trio. And then, you know, these other musicians. It's on MRC. So it was on The Complete Mercury, I think it was released there. It's been released separately. There's a number of versions of it. But it's a 9-track album. So her first stint with MRC, Mercury. And again, Mercury was the parent label, but they had a subsidiary called MRC that released jazz. So, you know, like Cannonball Adderley released stuff on there. I think we did a session by another vocalist, I can't remember who, that was also on MRC and had a jam session. I'll never remember it now. I feel terrible. Anyway, so what do you think of this? I think it gets a coronet from the Penguins.
Well, the one they give a coronet to is the Complete Blue Note of Pacific Jazz Recordings. This is from Brown. Well, they call the MRC calls it Brownie, the 10 CD set. You know, they
okay, just call so right, it. You can get it right. I mean, it's available both on her complete works and his, because he also recorded extensively for MRC. So yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I think we didn't talk about this, but it's worth, you know, it's kind of worth listening to discs 5 and 6. This is on disc 7, and it's worth listening to discs 5 and 6 just for reference point, because the sometimes put on the Mount Rushmore of singers, Dinah Washington is the singer on those discs, right?
Ah, yeah. So that maybe that's the one that we do Washington's album.
We might have done.
I think that may be it.
It's a jam session. It's a live.
The Washington, the one, yeah. Yeah, Dinah Jams, episode 40. Right, absolutely.
And, you know, she's a pretty fine singer in her own right. I don't think she's in the league of the great three. And those recordings are a little bit busier. And then when Brownie plays with Sarah Vaughan, it feels like... This does feel like a Desert Island disc in the sense that there's a lot of respect among the musicians. Doesn't it seem like that to you? In the sense that the tenor player and the horn and Sarah kind of all get equal billing, equal featured space. There's a lot of room for all of them in the sense that it feels kind of opened up. I don't know how to put it. The Dinah Washington recordings feel to me significantly busier, cluttered by comparison. And here one can kind of hone in on
Sarah
and just luxuriate in her voice and the interplay with Brown, who is, we should talk about him at some point. He's a monumental, hugely important player in his own right, who died far too young.
It's crazy, but I'm in love.
Yeah. and super influential on a generation of trumpet players. Yeah, it's awesome. Is there a particular cut on that that you love or that you are deeply into?
Well, I want you to finish up on this one because I've got a out of average response to this. I'm a little weird about this album, so.
Well, all right. I'll consider me finished up. I want to hear what you have to say.
Tell me. Go ahead. I don't think this is a Cornette album. I think it's got problems. I think it's.
What are they?
All right. To begin with, several of the songs suck. They're bad. I don't want to hear that shit.
It might as well be Spring. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, there are two or three, and you know, on a 9-song album, when two or three of the songs suck, and it's not that she doesn't perform them well. It's their content to me is a little bit. It's the kind of masochistic girl singing about the guy that kicks her in the guts and she keeps crawling back to him kind of stuff. You know, again, at the time, again, I'm putting my 21st century sensibilities onto them, though I also would argue they just aren't great songs. I don't think that Jim formally is a good song. I mean, it's adequate, but it's not. The melody's nothing special. The lyrics are not witty or anything. They're just kind of talking about this guy that treats her like crap and she still loves him. So I don't like the song selection. I think if you're going to look for a masterpiece, I don't want that many misses. The other problem I've got with it, well, all right. One, you can just call Herbie Mann. Herbie Mann and Cornette, those things don't happen. You know, Herbie Mann's on the session, half a star goes away. And, you know, his soloing is just, it's not great. I mean, they say, you know, the Penguins, he doesn't disgrace himself. It's like, well, no, you know, he doesn't like blow clunkers or something, but he's not great. The solos are not good. He does not solo as extensively as Quintet or Brownie, but the couple of them are just a little bit borderline painful. And I've always felt guilty about this. And I think one thing that in a sense is prevented me from getting as deeply into Vaughn as I should have earlier was This Is Where You Start, and I didn't like it that much.
Oh,
a September song, Where Man's Flute. I just, ooh. And then finally, Quintet, or I may be saying that wrong. Maybe it's Quintet. I'm not sure. The Vice President was his nickname. He was a Verve artist, and he's just doing Lester Young.
A good Lester Young.
It's good, but Lester Young and Clifford Brown aren't playing the same kind of music.
No, they're not.
You know, he is. It's like you got the swing era, and I love Lester Young. I mean, I don't get me wrong. I love his music, and of course, he's famous for duetting with Billie Holiday. But it's like, you know, he's trying to imitate the vibe that Lester had with Billie, with a different singer who's comfortable with Billie. Bebop, who's in a session with one of the foremost bebop trumpeters of all time, who's playing bebop.
Right.
And it just, to me, while each lament of those solos is okay, they don't add up to any kind of aesthetic whole, or they don't make sense. They're incongruous. So again, this is a very fine album. I don't think it is the masterpiece that people cut it out to be. I think there's a lot of other places you can encounter her singing that don't have these. And to me, the whole vibe of it is very good studio date. It is not the band found magic and play above their heads.
I take on board what you're saying. That's a good critique. That's a good point about the Vice President, especially. But what about her in particular on the beboppier of the numbers, Lullaby of Birdland?
Oh, you know, excellent.
Isn't she transcendent?
She's fucking awesome. I don't want to, you know, again, it's not like anything about this makes her singing anything other than superb. It's just that, again, given there are hours and hours and hours of her singing, this just isn't my favorite context for it. And she's amazing on some of them. And again, I just don't want to hear a voice that good singing Jim or singing. I fucking hate Jim. And I think
you don't like He's My Guy either.
Exactly. Yes. And I think part of it, too, is I listened to this album fairly young. And so when I'm coming to it, I am more coming from that viewpoint of the singer trying to be quote unquote sincere or self-expressing, which you kind of learn and pick up from the aesthetics of pop and more so from rock. And of course, the dissonance there is less disturbing if you're used to singers like an Ella Fitzgerald who can sing it while looking for the lipstick. And it's not about who she is. It's about what a gorgeous voice singing this. Again, I'm going to argue, not only are the lyrics not great, I just don't think it's a good song. I don't think He's My Guy is a good song. You know, you can have really well put together bits of music that have ideological problems but work aesthetically. I just don't think they succeed either place. And throughout her career, and maybe it's because she was more, you know, it's hard to say. She certainly had people attempt to be her Svengali, like Mitch Miller. But for the most part, she could be pretty strong-willed. I don't know who's picking the stuff out for, and surely just the sheer volume of what she recorded, you're going to get some clunkers. But, you know, again, this is a really good album. But for me, coming back to it, having started with it, I came back, I'm like, nope, I still just don't like it. And then I had to think a little bit more analytically about why, and I'd say,
okay,
you know, the musicians don't blend. Some of the song selections I think are weak, and I don't think the band catches fire. I think they're very professional and very good. I don't know that I've heard an MRC state, except maybe some of Clifford Brown's best, where I don't know why. I mean, the vibe I get from those sessions for the most part is not one of, you know, the magic you get on the best Blue Notes. Not most of them, the best. Or, I don't know, I mean, the best Dials, for God's sake, so the sound is shit, but, you know, they're playing well. Anyway, so enough on that.
I would just rate it, I agree with you, it's not Desert Island Disc, but I'd rate it a little higher just for her interpretations of Lullaby of Birdland and the notoriously difficult April in Paris.
April in Paris, chestnuts in blossom, holiday tables under the trees, April in Paris. This is a feeling no one can ever.
Not an easy song for any singer.
And she just nails it. Yeah, she can sing pretty much anything she fucking wants to sing. You know?
Yeah, like, I mean,
it just doesn't matter to her. She can do it.
You have the sense that Sinatra studied this and Ella before he had cracks at these songs. You know, it's like, all right, let's hear what the best to do with this before I venture into these waters.
And he is very gifted, but not as gifted vocally. No. He does not have a once in a lifetime. And, you know, one of the things this biographer talked about is Ella's ability to nail large leaps or intervals in music.
You mean Sarah?
Sarah, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, and I know as a really bad tenor, anything much more than a third for me, I have to really, it's like, you know, you're kind of tentatively jumping off, hoping you'll hit the bucket of water.
Right.
But, you know, it just nothing mattered. She just, any note for to any note, perfect intonation, perfect landing, no sense of strain.
Right.
She can do
she
it
can
all.
Go up to her upper register from anywhere, and just it's flawless. The only, like, the example that immediately leaps to mind, and it's a rock example, is Jeff Buckley, who's within a certain range of notes in his falsetto. He can go from his tenor to his falsetto, and it's like, holy shit, wow. But she's like that all the time, every time, from anywhere.
Yeah. And, you know, she had a 3-octave voice, yes, at least.
Yes.
Whereas.
And there's no strain, none all in her highest registers. There's never a sense that this is effort. It's all, it just sounds effortless.
Yeah. And of course, just throughout it, it's powerful. It's rounded. It's completely controlled. Again, just a once in a lifetime kind of instrument.
Just a gigolo everywhere you go. People know the part you're playing. Paid for every dance, selling each romance. Every night some heart betraying.
So the next one we looked at was a live date from 1957. I was not able to get a good copy of this. I kind of had to stream it from Amazon. It's pretty rough. At Mr. Kelly's, it's a trio date, Jimmy Jones piano, Richard Davis on bass, and Roy Haynes on drums.
Dick Davis is the bass player.
I know, and you wouldn't guess it from this, but, you know, he appreciated her artistry, and these guys, you know, you're going to get more work and make a little more money. She was apparently pretty fair to her sidemen in terms of payment, working for a vocalist than you will with an instrumentalist, typically. It's just they're more popular. And this was originally like a 9-song album that was expanded to 20 songs. It shows her kind of, I mean, really, she doesn't have a peak. She's good for decades, but still fairly young, live, singing a lot of jazz, improvising when things go wrong, joking with the audience. It's kind of her live. I found it really enjoyable. What do you think about Mr. Kelly's?
I like most of it. There's one of the song. Oh, I think it's which song is it where she's going to say that, which one I want to say is it How High the Moon?
I'm singing it like
Ella. So Ella had this habit of fucking with the words from time to time on live dates, which I can imagine when you watch her do it live, it's fun. But hearing her on a recording do it, it always bugs the shit out of me. That date in Hollywood, three nights in Hollywood or whatever, Ella does that, and she does it on How High the Moon, and she does it on Blue Moon, where she just totally fucks with the lyrics.
Yeah.
Which is, it's fun, like, the first time, and then I'm like, all right. And one can only imagine that she did that every night. So, yeah, it was a surprise to me listening to this when I first got to How High the Moon. I was like, oh no, she's going to do Ella? She's going to do Ella fucking with the word? Really? Is that necessary? I was like, it would be like if Art Tatum suddenly decided to play chopsticks. I'm like, really, dude?
Which he might have, but yeah.
I know, he might have, but he would have like turned it into a giant concerto. It's just, I'm like, really? That's what you're going to do with your voice? You're going to do that song that way? I mean, that's one of the moments in Ella's repertoire that gets under my skin the most. It irritates me. And the last thing I wanted is to hear Sarah Vaughan imitate Ella Fitzgerald slumming, you know. I'm like, come on, just don't sing that song. First of all, I don't like How High the Moon anyway. I don't think it's the greatest. You like it?
Well, as a song, as a set of lyrics, not particularly. As a harmonic progression,
stupid.
Right? It was called the National Anthem of Bebop, right? It's got a great set of changes,
right?
And so there, I think that's. And of course, the other thing to keep in mind, and I don't want to overemphasize this. I don't know how true it was, but in a sense, just as Fitzgerald was haunted by the ability of other singers with less talent to move units, Vaughan is aware of Fitzgerald as, you know, this singer who is kind of the only one close to her sphere technically, who has a larger popular following and just does a little better financially. So there's that sense of, I don't want to say parody, I don't think it's mean-spirited or she's
no,
sarcastic.
No, not at all.
But that reference point that, you know, Fitzgerald's famous for this, I can do this too, and of course she could.
Right. And I kind of, you know, as a purist, it's not a moment that I'm particularly happy about. There's several cuts here that I kind of dig. I love it when any singer can do Dancing in the Dark.
Looking for the light of a new love to brighten up the night.
I think Dancing in the Dark is a fiendishly difficult song to perform. There's an old Mel Brooks joke about – it's Mel Brooks' joke. It's an old joke about old Jews who sing that song and they start it too high and then they have a heart attack before they finish the song because it's just – it's a very difficult song.
You know, I grew up with the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz, a 6-LP set from the 70s or something. And one of her feature tracks on that is Dancing in the Dark. And I always was just struck. I mean, it's just the rendition in that set is incredibly gorgeous. And she just absolutely, you know, nails it. And that was kind of, you know, the first Sarah Vaughan I ever heard. Yeah, it's a great song. But it's hard to sing.
It's incredibly difficult to sing. And one has to have a huge range. And one has to be really comfortable negotiating up to the top of one's range. And she's just, you know, it's a live recording. And she just destroys it. I mean, she's so good on that song. For me, maybe the cut that is the signature Sarah sound in some ways is Just a Gigolo. it's the way she slurs the fucking notes. I mean, she has that, she gets that little girly creep into her voice. I love that. But then she's the same woman who can sing Thou Swell, which is from that Broadway production, Kiss Me Kate, right? It's a song from a Broadway production, you know, and it's full of tricky diction and she's wonderful. My God. I mean, there's just not much she can't do and do incredibly well. But yeah, I like this date quite a lot. I think I Cover the Waterfront is fantastic. I think Dancing in the Dark is fantastic. I love Just a Gigolo. Those for me are, you know, kind of high points, but really you could just pick any cut here and they're all pretty damn good. Even the songs that are not that interesting.
Gold-plated, yeah.
You know, I'm going to sit right down. It's like, okay.
Oh, fine. Well, I mean, to be honest.
You like that song?
We know that. Thank you. We're going to do one we know now. Sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Well, compared to some of the Drek that, you know, compared to Jim, it's a cute song, right? You know, Fats Waller, I'll take over whoever wrote Jim any day of the week. So, but yeah,
I totally, yes, of course. But just because Saint Fats wrote it doesn't mean it's good, you know, or doesn't mean that it's a great song.
Well, I don't know if it's great, but I mean, it's just a constructed piece. The language, the melody, it's accomplished. A little annoying, sure, but yeah, I think, you know, the miracle of this is, and of course, I did not grow up with this album. I never had the 9-track. But listening to 20 tracks instead of 9, it never felt like it drugged to me. You know,
Right.
It's, and they aren't, you know, these are, she's not Betty Carter out here doing melisma for 10 minutes straight on one tune. These are fairly succinct 2 to 4 minute renditions for the most part. It's a club set, but it's just at a super high level. And you can hear the band real well, especially in the version I was able to come up with. You know, I go onto Amazon and the new CD of this is $40.
Hmm.
Just, you know, again, this is a Stone classic from her classic period. It should be available, you'd think, like water, right? It should be something that would be as cheap as just any of the major artists' albums, which for the most part, their catalog stuff is like $7 now. I mean, it's available, but she's not in print in the States, apparently, with this. Now, you can get a copy of it. It's not like it's inaccessible, but it's just kind of striking. It's like, wow, you know, why is it this acknowledged near masterpiece or certainly major work from one of the greatest jazz vocalists of the 20th century? Why isn't it readily available? Why is this, you know, and I guess, again, it's her, you know, her reputation. There's no cult around her to the same extent there is around a Fitzgerald or a Holiday even now. So, but yeah, I strongly recommend it. I think it's good. And, you know, she kind of jokes around some, oh, I messed that one up. It's, you know, it's a club date. They don't have a lot of patter in it, but they're trying to kind of capture that atmosphere. So if you don't like those kind of interjections at all, you might find it wearisome at times. But I think it's pretty good.
Yeah, I do too. I like it a lot.
Smoking, drinking, never thinking of tomorrow, nonchalant, diamonds shining, dancing, dining with some man in a rest.
So the next two, we're going to do, as I said, a roulette kind of best of. But I thought, well, those are really tough to deal with because you don't know who's doing what. There's no unification to it. So when I realized I had two complete albums of hers on one CD, both in the same format, I thought, well, maybe we should do these. They're both duet albums with a bass player and a guitarist. Let me get the personnel there. Sarah Plus Two from 1962 is with Barney Kessel on guitar and Joe Comfort bass. What a great name.
Yeah.
After Hours from 61, these are both on roulette, with Munda Lowe on guitar and George Duvivier, I don't know how to say it.
Duvivier. Bass.
Yeah. Very great French bass player, played with Bud Powell, among others, on bass. So among Roulette's other offerings, and you know, they did a lot of, she was only there a couple years, but they did 8 CDs worth. So,
yeah,
you know, well over 10 albums. I don't know how many, were these two duet sessions. What do you think about plus two in After Hours.
This is a lot of fun. And if you just want to take a bath in Sarah's voice, this is the thing, right? Kessel is just as unobtrusive and helpful an accompanist as you could possibly want in this setting. I'm not a huge Kessel fan in the first place. And one of the signature characteristics of his playing is how restrained and tasteful he is. And he's just perfect because I'm not listening to him at all here.
No, right. Yeah.
He's just there kind of this is just, you really can just listen to her here. He has almost nothing to do. And man, God, her voice. I mean, I'm going to pick just one cut, right? Because we could talk about tons of them. I'll talk about a couple of cuts. I love My Favorite Things.
Oh, yeah. God, isn't that great? Yeah.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens. Bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens. Brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things.
I don't think it's the best song from Sound of Music, which has, I think, a number of songs that, you know, became jazz classics. But my God, this has to be the definitive rendition of that song as far as I'm concerned. She takes it in this minor key and she just fucking emotes all over this song. And it is iconic. I mean, it is an absolute gem of a rendition of this song. I think it's my favorite version of this song. And I hadn't heard it until I think I have After Hours, but I just had forgotten it. And I heard this and I was like, oh, fuck, that is so good. Holy shit. It's just... It's unbelievable. It is for me one of the great, great, great versions of that song. I can't think of a better one.
Right. Yeah. John Coltrane's soprano's great, but
yeah, no, this is in terms of just sheer feeling. God, she's just all over that song.
Well, it's tricky emotionally. You can be too cute with it.
Exactly.
There's just so many ways it could go wrong. I remember Elvis Costello describing Hell as listening to it again and again, but it's by Julie Andrews, not by John Coltrane. I don't know that I've got anything against Julie, but, you know, it was the hipster's nightmare would be having to listen to the straight version of this. This is neither of those things. It's not Coltrane. It's not Julie Andrews. It's Vaughn. And yeah. It is kind of perfect. Yeah.
Oh, it's just, it's so beautiful. On that same album, Easy to Love, I just think is wonderful. I mean, everything's wonderful. But again, it's the way that she kind of gets playful and slurs the notes. She's having so much fun with that song. You have the sense that she actually is looking at you and saying, you'd be so easy to love. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's the way she sings the song that she's actually selling the lyric, which no one sells that lyric. No one actually takes the lyrics to Easy to Love and thinks, what is this song about? It's about how easy it would be to fall in love with this person right here. And Sarah makes you think she's fallen in love with you, with the way she kind of gets girlish and playful and kind of bends the notes. And it's just a masterpiece of interpretation. But there's so many good songs on here. There's so many wonderful moments. I even can tolerate Just Squeeze Me, which normally I'm not a fan of that song.
Oh, come on. It's by Ellington. It must be good.
You like a bunch of crap songs. Really? You like Just Squeeze Me?
Well, you know...
An ode to an orange. What?
Yeah. As a melody, as a tune, I think it's fine. Yeah, it's...
But the words, Patrick!
I know. Well, but this is, you know, this is a boundary that Vaughn is on.
Yes.
And that many pop musicians, you know, this sense of being interested in the harmonic matrices of songs more than the quote-unquote content, the melody necessarily, or certainly not the words or the meaning of the words. And she kind of straddles that divide. Sometimes she's boring into the verbal meaning. Sometimes it's more about the sheer sound.
Right.
Again, one that can become sickeningly cloying, Just Squeeze Me. And I've heard it, you know, like Rain Ants or whoever it is that does it for Ellington. It's a bit much.
Mm-hmm.
But she's able to walk the line where, you know, she's cute, but she's thoughtful, she's funny, but she's not jokey.
Right.
It just comes off beautifully. And, of course, she can sing the fucking thing.
Yes.
Nine Ways to Sunday. So, and not that she's showing – I just – to me, if I was going to ask or tell a newcomer or suggest to a newcomer where to come to her, I'd say try this. If you can't get into these albums, you probably aren't going to like Sarah Vaughan. But it's just mainly the guitar. They're tasteful. They keep things going. They get the fuck out of her way.
Yeah.
And she just sings. And it's just, and I think overall the tune stacks here are better than average batting. They're not perfect. I think When Sunny Gets Blue is kind of weird when you're singing about a dude. Maybe that's just my gender issue. Key Largo, I don't know. I mean, it's not bad. It's just one of those, it's an odd song. But for the most part, I think these are sturdier bits of material than sometimes she was saddled with. I think the batting average is much higher than with Clifford Brown.
Yeah.
And of course, it's just, it sounds gorgeous.
Baby, won't you please come home? 'Cause your mama's all alone. I have tried in vain, never no more to call your name. When you left, you broke my heart, because I never thought we'd.
I mean, I don't know that I think of Roulette as a label that always made brilliant sounding records, but they nail it here. It's not a difficult job. It's just two instruments and a voice, but they do a good, I mean, it's just, you can bathe in it. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah. It's just her. And, you know, I was just thinking, here's the other thing. I'll compare it to someone else we've talked about before. We've talked about Carmen McRae, and as Carmen McRae got older, is it Carmen McRae? I think it's Carmen McRae. Who's the singer? It's not, it's Etta Jones. Etta Jones does like the Tarzan vocal. Remember when she gets older? Right? Sarah will slur. Sarah bends notes fiendishly. She does it a lot. She rarely sings the vocal line straight. She won't just sing the notes as they're printed. She will bend a lot of them. But she's always in control when she does it. And late Ella bends notes a lot, and I don't think she's in control. Like, Ella is really fucking around, and one has the sense that she's... late Ella reminds me of, like, a truck going too fast down a two-lane mountain highway, and she's careening dangerously close to the edges often. And Sarah, I never feel like she's out of control, and she will do this more as she gets older. And she still is never out of control. One always feels like she knows exactly where this note is going. She's bending it precisely the way she wants it to. And she resolves these slight shifts in tone beautifully every time. I mean, and she just is so – she's a master. She's a master at her craft. And this is really demonstrates it.
Yeah, we actually talk about Carmen McRae's Sarah, Dedicated to You album back on 65, and also talk about a Natalie Cole album on that podcast.
Yes.
So, of the three, obviously Holiday, not obviously if you haven't listened extensively to her last couple albums are Staring Death in the Face. She's barely able to croak her way through the stuff. They're painful to listen to. Some people find them very moving, but she's technically a wreck. Ella Fitzgerald does a couple duet albums on Pablo with Joe Pass.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got one of those and I realized it's not that she can't sing anymore, but her instrument has coarsened. She's just not at the peak she was in the 50s. It just, and for Fitzgerald especially, she's the kind of singer whose perfection is one of her greatest attractions. So when she's not perfect anymore, she doesn't have the kind of Billie Holiday pathos to fall back on. Vaughn, she gets deeper, but man, she never really loses a step. At all. It's just, you know, she sounds different. She doesn't do exactly the same thing she used to do, but what she's doing, she just does fucking pinpoint perfectly. And, you know, aside from times when, you know, she might have had a bad live performance because she wasn't feeling great, or she might just go a little overboard because she really got excited about the Chocolate Fountain and just kind of got lost in it. But man, as far as just controlling what she does, never loses a step. But of course here, this is her at her absolute peak. And man, I would, you know, if you want to get into her, I cannot recommend these strongly enough. To me, they are more valuable than with Clifford Brown.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think they don't
have that reputation. You know, they're well regarded, but you know, they aren't getting the crowns. They aren't getting the must here. And it's partially, I'm sure it's Roulette is just a lesser known label run by, I believe, gangsters. I think the gambling reference was, you know, not kind of on the nose there. And it's had moments of public availability and moments of disappearing. But I think probably Blue Note owns them now or something. Thank God. But until they got a corporate parent, they were kind of hard to track down. But yeah, absolutely. And this is in print. You can get the two albums on one CD for under $15. You obviously can stream most of the stuff. You can stream live at Mr. Kelly's. You can stream the Clifford Brown, I believe. But yeah, you want to listen to these.
Yep.
Copacabana, lovely place in Brazil, where every pair of eyes will give you a thrill. Ask any good romancer, he'll give you just one answer. Copacabana.
I'm going to say something controversial about our last selection or two here.
Well, obviously, we don't want to break your hearts, people, but no Barry Manilow. Right there. I know. Once I realized that it was not, I just like, where's Barry? Come on, damn it. The Copa. For those of you that grew up in a certain decade, you know what I mean. And I apologize for the flashbacks you're having right now. Yeah, Copacabana, this is one of her several albums on Pablo. It's one of her several Brazilian albums. Towards the end of her career, she got into Brazilian music. She does I Love Brazil, which I think I've already described as maybe the best of those.
And apparently she toured down there and she was a huge, huge star. They loved her in Brazil. What does that say? That this great voice wasn't unappreciated in the U.S., but she felt a kind of adulation
right
in Brazil that she never felt here.
Maybe we'll think about it a little towards the end. It's her reception is why it wasn't greater is an interesting aesthetic question and also economic question, because she is, again, as you listen to this stuff, you realize, I mean, this is a fantastic singer. This is an unusually mm-hmm. gifted singer. And I think if you cherry pick her stuff, she is, you know, no more mannered or self-indulgent than the other faces up there on Rushmore. And she's got better or at least equivalent vocal equipment to anybody. So why isn't she better known, better loved? So yeah, we picked the last one is that we wanted one late one. We did also listen to Brazilian Romance from 87, which is kind of her final leader date. And then, you know, she gets lung cancer at the end there and dies, as I said before, in 90. There's no Brazilian Romance. She still sounds great. This is earlier, Copacabana, again on Pablo. She had struggled trying to find a home for herself and Norman Grant's, who she found a bit bossy and perhaps vice versa. She has strong opinions too, kind of brought her into the fold and made several albums with her that a lot of people regard very highly. So what are your thoughts about Copacabana?
I almost like these a little better. Okay, so the production values are kind of weird. We've got some vocal backing, which I'm not always keen on. There's some overhyped production behind her. It's worse on Brazilian Romance, in fact.
Oh, yeah. It's very 80s there. Yeah.
Very 80s. But my God, this woman's voice. So here's what's so amazing about Copacabana, and then even more on Brazilian Romance. She still has a really amazing top. Like Copacabana, she's in her higher register there. And yet now she can drop down really low. And she does it in the same song often. And it's flawless. And it's just jaw-dropping.
You're not supposed to be able to sing every part in a Wagner opera. That's just not right.
It's unbelievable.
She can be the heroine and the villain. Yeah.
The vocalist she reminds me of here is latter career Cassandra Wilson. Her voice is deepened. You know, she is
out of the basement.
Oh, my God. I mean, there are cuts with Wynton Marsalis that I heard, and I was like, who is that guy? And then I looked, and I'm like, oh, my God, it's Cassandra Wilson. You know?
Right.
I mean, she sounds amazing, but that's her. And Cassandra Wilson doesn't have the same top that Sarah Vaughan has, but Sarah Vaughan still had that. And she could go so low, and her tone in the lower registers is just fucking gorgeous. I mean, I could listen to her voice all day long. And on Copacabana, that particular song, she's fairly high in her register, and there's no diminution of power. There's no lessening of control over her tone. And it's a trivial song. None of these songs are great. Probably the most famous song here is Gingy.
Like the song of the wind in the trees, that's how my heart is singing, Gingy. Happy, happy Gingy. When you're with me,
this is all stuff from the jazz samba, you know, crossover era. And I think Double Rainbow is another song that one picks up in a few places. None of this material is stellar.
Well, Sinatra does a lot of them, though. Some of them are, you know, he did two albums of Bossa, but he shelved the second one that didn't come out, I believe, until after he died.
Yeah.
And a lot of these tunes are on those performances.
Yeah, and the tunes themselves are not particularly memorable, but Jesus, seriously, talk about someone who I could listen to sing in the phone book. And she's actually perfectly fine in these songs. She seems to grok the mode or the mood here, and is compelling in singing these songs. I'm struck even more on Brazilian Romance, because some of those songs are deeply stupid. Make the City Ours Tonight is just dumb.
Yeah,
but
80s draws,
I mean,
yeah.
Holy cats.
I know.
She's amazing on this incredibly stupid song. With its overhyped, over busy production values, synthesizers, guitars, and flutes and nonsense behind her. And her diction is flawless, her enunciation, and she just sells it. I'm like, yeah, Sarah, let's make this city ours. Let's do it. Let's do it. You know?
Right, yeah.
Magic expectation, the evening is starting to shine. Neon color romance, the promise that you could be mine. Streets are full of music, my heart memorizes the song. I want to dance on the rooftops, so don't keep me waiting so long. My imagination is changing the skyline.
I can't get enough of this woman's voice. And like I said, as an older singer, the tone deepened, it became more burnished, and she never, I never feel that she's out of control of what she's doing here. I mean, she's just the consummate craftsman. And this is, you know, really late in the career, and she's still amazing. And when I say that, I'm not saying like amazing, like, oh, it's amazing, she could still sing at all. I mean, no.
No, she's still fucking kicking ass.
There are a few people who could do this, you know.
Ever.
I can't think of anyone who can match her range, certainly not at that age. So she's just, I mean, I love this stuff. And I recognize how trivial the material is. I don't care. I would listen to her singing this trivial Brazilian material over her singing trivial, you know, pop songs from the 40s and 30s. I would easily take this over that stuff.
Well, she seems to like the mood. She seems to be energized by it. But she's just one of these freaks of nature, because, you know, Sinatra, to me, some people, you know, really just every note he fucking sang, they want to know about. I kind of leave him soon after the Capitol years.
Yep.
But one of my favorite reprise sessions are these Bossas, and it's because they favor minimalism, the ranges aren't extensive, and his voice is starting to go, and he's starting to be self-indulgent, but he groks exactly how to deliver them, and it's my favorite late singing by him. Of course, that's early 60s. I mean, duets, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to think about,
no.
You know. But in a sense, what happens is he is able to mold his current limitations to exploit that kind of genre, and just thrive in it. Whereas she doesn't have any fucking limitations. She just likes the music. It's like, and she's much older at this point than he was doing the stuff in the 60s. He just lived a hard life. But she lived a hard life. She's
maybe harder.
She smoked, yeah. I mean,
she wasn't as rich.
No one beat Sinatra. In fact, one point when one of her husbands like ran off or beat her something, he's like, yeah, you want me to break it? I get somebody to break his legs. You want me to do that? And she's like, no, thank you, Frank. I'd rather you not. You know, but apparently, you know, he offered to have someone go come around and break this guy's legs for. So he was the guy that was inflicting the pain. You know, she's suffered a lot, but whatever she did, her habits, all the rest of it, her voice just didn't go. I mean, she just didn't lose it. I mean, most singers, they kind of use their voice up. Certainly by 60, it's gone. And it just, I don't know how it happened, but it is deeper. But other than that, it's still fucking good. You know, it's like, damn, how do you do that? Yeah, I'm going to make a mission of mine. I went through eMusic many, many years ago. And for a while, they had these really low bitrate MP3s. And so these are very early ones when they had, Pablo was one of the labels owned by Fantasy. So I got a couple of these, and my mission is to go find them as used vinyl. I'm sure they're out there.
Oh, and I bet they're wonderful. I bet they sound fantastic.
I bet they sound great. I want to get all her Pablos, because as far as I know, they're all very highly considered. And I think what had happened is she'd kind of been in the desert a few years, husband trouble, label trouble, and just the whole sense that, you know, as the 70s come on, a lot of jazz musicians are just lost. They don't know what to do. It's so tough to know aesthetically what they're supposed to pursue. You know, even Fitzgerald, I think, did like a Beatles album.
Right.
Though I think mostly she just kind of kept doing her stuff. And, in a way, I think Vaughn was a little bit more restless than that and wanted to find new things to do. And, you know, an example would be Sendin' the Clowns, which worked beautifully for her, but just wasn't quite sure where to go. And I don't know that she certainly never had a producer like a Norman Granz, who I felt like did a certain amount of the thinking for Fitzgerald's career. I don't want to be condescending to her, but kind of helped give her an aesthetic direction and a framing and just set up this idea that this is a very special artist who deserves the best, and then let her run with that, as opposed to you're a singer looking for gigs, looking for the next label to help put out your product, but you don't necessarily have the best advice as to how to frame what you've got. Because again, Vaughn is as good a singer as Fitzgerald, if not better. I mean, there's just no way around it. She's just fucking incredible. So, yeah, I really enjoy doing this. I'm so glad you suggested it, because by thinking through what we had available and picking out stuff that, you know, was really good Vaughn, I feel like I finally kind of broke through into really enjoying and getting into her stuff in a way I hadn't before, partially because of Jim, partially because, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that is just very well sung dreck, very well sung crap, very well sung dross, so the settings aren't necessarily sympathetic for, they don't necessarily click. You know, like she does some stuff with big bands, you know, arranged by Benny Carter, but it's not his most interesting arranging stuff, and it's fine, it's not bad, but it's nothing like the best stuff on these albums. It's just not, it's not her in her best setting, which generally is the less the better, because she's so fucking good. But I don't mind Brazilian stuff. I was struck, she sings, one of the songs on this album is also on Paul Desmond's From the Hot Afternoon.
Oh, which one?
Say Goodbye. Really? And there's an anecdote in the liners to the Desmond album that says, well, the singer, when she tried to sing it, the key was too low for her, so she's really straining and everything. And Desmond said, no, don't re-record it. It's more moving that way.
Hmm.
I think, really, don't re-record it. I want to go get a martini. Well, whatever the reason was. And so, of course, when Vaughn sings, it's like, oh, yeah, it's going to be too low. I don't fucking think so. You know, every note perfectly done, no strain at all. She could probably do it an octave lower if she wanted to. But I knew that song really well because, you know, growing up, that was one of the first 50 records I owned. And it's like, oh, my God, this is how it's supposed to sound. So it was just kind of cool there.
What I would give gold for would be, who's the, it's gone out of my head, Black, Brown, and Beige. Who's the singer on those?
Oh, I know who you mean. Mahalia Jackson. Mahalia Jackson.
Great singer. I would love to have heard Sarah do those songs.
Right, with the full bebop vocabulary and the humor. You know, we talked about it, and I guess it's worth thinking for a minute before we go on to Pop Matters, just about, and it's all speculation, you can't prove anything, but, you know, why was it that she did not do as well as Fitzgerald? And I think part of it is just economics. She had a string of bad managers who she happened to marry, who I don't think were making great decisions or helping her make great decisions. When she did want to make her own decisions, people kept pushing back because she was a woman, because she was African American. So she had trouble controlling her career as well, and she was not somebody who wanted to do the business end of it. And then just, you know, the humor, the personality. She's more present. She's more there, both in her self-indulgence and in her earnestness emotionally, I think, than like a Fitzgerald. And so, you know, if it worries you that she might not be serious or that she might just be intimidating because she's so fully present and so incredibly talented and not, you know, not always playing girly stuff. I don't know. What is it that kept her from being as popular as Fitzgerald? You can't answer the question, but I think it's some combination of, you know, she could be sometimes challenging in a way that Fitzgerald wasn't, and she never had a curator the way Fitzgerald did. I don't know, but it doesn't help to label hop. There's no one person that decided, you know, Sarah Vaughan is so important, you just need to help her create a legacy. There was nobody quite like that for her. She was like, Sarah Vaughan's got a really good voice. Let's see how many singles we can get out of her.
Right.
And it's just and she made a lot of great music, but you feel like she could have done even more, and she could have gotten more recognition if, I don't know, there'd been a little bit more help from the industry, and also just, you know, maybe she was just too, I don't want to say willful, but challenging in the sense both emotionally and technically that people were a little put off by it. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I get the sense that, you know, how they talk about, sometimes they'll talk about writers, and they'll talk about such and such a person as a writer's writer.
Right, yeah.
Which is a nice way of saying they're not as commercially viable as other writers. But writers who know writing really admire them, really look up to them. You know, there's a writer's writer. And she might be an example of the singer's singer. Any singer who knows anything about singing is going to be like, oh my God, Sarah Vaughan.
Right.
You can't get around the fact that this woman is a titan. She is an absolute. She is on Mount Rushmore. And she deserves to be there. And yeah, you know, there's a kind of, maybe people approach her with a kind of po-faced seriousness. I don't know. I don't know what it is. I prefer her to Ella. I mean, you know, Ella is awesome. I love Ella and I love Billy. But I think I prefer Sarah Vaughan just as when she's invested in a lyric.
Yeah.
She's just amazing.
Well, I guess one way I would think about it is that for Vaughan, her personality, her selfhood is always kind of bubbling and almost overflowing, and the material is as much a vehicle for expressing that, her musicianship, her humor, her mood swings. Fitzgerald, who I just think had a smaller personality, just was not, could become more invisible, could be more just a vehicle, especially in the songbook projects for a song. And so I don't know whether it was that, you know, that you're always kind of dealing with Sarah when you hear Sarah. And I think sometimes the alchemy of her with the right material is just fireworks. You know, it's incredible.
Right.
But whether that just put people off, that they preferred a more recessive singer who was a little bit more willing to kind of disappear into the music, I don't know. I mean, of course, the other end of the spectrum, Billie Holiday, much more so than Sarah, was all about the persona. But then it was also a very easily parsable persona, especially towards the end of the suffering woman. And I don't think Vaughan, you know, she could be the sexually aggressive woman. She could be the funny woman. She could be the suffering woman. She, you know, she was, I think, just more multifaceted, handful, I guess is a way of putting it, you know.
I think that's probably true. And I just also think that to put it slightly different way, Sarah never recorded anything quite as ridiculous as A Tisket a Tasket, but if she had, she would have just sold it on her lyrical ability. Like, she's like, okay, this is bullshit, but watch what I can do with this.
Yeah, I think Mitch Miller did his best. I don't know.
He tried to take her there. Yeah.
I try not to, you know, this is true. I mean, for me, Fitzgerald, I just don't listen to her Decca stuff. I'm sure there's some stuff of value there, but it's just like I don't really listen to Sinatra's Columbia stuff. I'm sure there's, and probably I should, just in terms of, that's probably when he's at his peak as a singer, per se. And so, yeah, I don't listen to the Columbia stuff that Vaughan does because, you know, life is short and Mitch Miller was an asshole. But yeah, the three of them, you know, you feel like she could never be completely subsumed. You know, there's always going to be the kind of will coming through, the will to be, you know.
If she gets a crap lyric, she has the voice to do something with it, even if she can't possibly begin to invest herself in it. She will just, sheer technique will make something of it.
Feel so smoochy when I hold your hand and look in your eyes. I feel I touch your lips and I realize that to hold you near make rainbows appear, and life is just one long kiss. While the moon looks down and the stars kind of frown and say, golly, just look what we missed.
So anyway, I fantastic singer, and I feel like one that if you just wanted to start out and look for stuff by her, you know, everybody would probably say, you know, Ellen Berlin, or if you wanted to have the more Ella songstress, you know, sings Port or sings Gershwin.
Right.
Billy, you know, most people are going to say, well, get everything. But if you want to do that, that's really finally not that hard. You know, probably 5 discs if Master takes on Verve and, you know, 8 on Columbia and then, you know, 2 on Commodore, maybe 1 and you're done. I mean, that's really her whole history.
I don't know why anyone would get the late stuff unless you just want to.
Yeah, some people
unless
love
you're
it.
A masochist or you like to hear
or a sadist
suffer.
Or something. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's scarifying. Vaughn, it's just there's a lot out there, and I don't think it's been well curated. I don't know that the best stuff necessarily automatically surfaces, and some of her best recordings are just kind of stone classics, aren't necessarily in print or at least in print at reasonable prices. It's just a little harder to find stuff, but I don't think any of these recordings can go wrong with probably most people who don't have my hang-ups will like with Clifford Brown better than I do, but all of them are really excellent examples of vocal jazz.
Yep.
All right. Well, again, thanks for bringing that idea up. I don't know that I would have thought of her, and I'm so glad you did. I now kind of want to keep exploring her music and sorting through what, you know, works for me and vibrates to me and what, you know, I just have to learn. It's like, okay, this is the kind of Vaughn I just don't, I admire, but don't, you know, emotionally engage with. But I know where there's good stuff now.
100 days, 100 nights, but no one man's heart. 100 days, 100 nights, but no one man's heart.
Anyway, Pop Matters on your mind?
The only new stuff that I've a lot of old stuff circulating at the moment, but I just picked up 100 Days and 100 Nights by Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. Okay. I have their Christmas album and I have something else by them, but this is the one after Naturally that cemented their arrival, and yeah, it's pretty good. It's, you know, basically it's someone who's like, you know what, Motown was cool, analog was cool, so let's do that. And they did it. And it's just, it's a solid 3-star album. I enjoy the heck out of it. I'm sorry she's gone. There are people who, there's been a kind of blues revival. Who are those guys? The Black Keys. There's people who are sort of going for that analog blues, Motown, R&B, soul feel. And I'm still not sure that anyone is as good as Marvin Gaye or Curtis Mayfield on their best days. But, well, more power to people that they want to record stuff in this idiom and do this. And so, yeah, I like this album a lot. I don't know if you know it, 100 Days, 100 Nights. It's just square in, you know, Motown R&B renaissance. It's even got the vocal effects to make it sound, you know, like it's being recorded on vinyl or whatever. And okay, whatever. It's fine. I like it. I think it's terrific. I don't think it's the second coming or anything. I do think that there's a lot of hipsters out there who orgasm maybe a little too eagerly over this shit, but I like it. I don't think it's the be all and end all, but I do like it. I'm sorry. I think she died of liver failure or something recently, in the last 4 or 5 years. But I don't know if you've heard the album, but it's pretty good. And they clock in at like 35, 30 minutes, you know, and it's like, yeah, that's how it should be. I don't need an 80-minute R&B album with 50 minutes of filler. Give me 34 minutes of it's a hit and I'm happy, you know?
Yeah. I only know the Christmas album, which is fantastic. And Days of Hanukkah is just, I love that fucking song. It's so funny, but not in a, you know, they're just having a great fun with it. I was trying to think who it was. Black Coffee by Beth Hart and Joe Bonamassa.
That's a good one.
And that is very much in that. And then, you know, I talked, I think last time, and the review is up now, about the Charlie Hunter gig that I saw. And, you know, if nothing else, my thought about that is, you know, when you see musicians like that, his vocalist himself, it's like you're seeing musicians in real time nail shit. And sometimes I don't feel like I appreciate that quite enough because I'm used to such high levels of musicianship from jazz players. But it's like, man, if you've grown up on EDM, it's like, no, there are people that actually can fucking sing in front of an audience, no auto-tune, in no programming, no electronic backing track. They just make the music in front of you and they're good at it every time. Yeah. Just like Sarah Vaughan, it's like, this is not easy to do. Most of the people who make millions of dollars doing this can't fucking touch the hem of her garment, as you know, in terms of musicianship. But if you really want to see what it is to be a musician, listen to these people. You might not like, you know, I don't know that the Hunter group is profound or something. They're very entertaining, but nothing else. They can fucking play and sing, you know. It's like, damn.
Here she comes. You better watch your step. She's gone to break your heart in two.
Well, is that your only selection? Cause
yeah, that's the only one.
I'm still digitizing old stuff, so I want to talk about a couple of the world's greatest vocalists. Of course, I mean the Velvet Underground and Nico. There are some singers. Lou Reed, he had a gift. And I recorded that in their third album, which I've had in vinyl for years and years and years and years. And incredibly influential stuff. I think that the fact the Rock Press was located in New York and the Velvet Underground is New York as fuck has some to do with their reputation. In other words, that they were kind of built up by homers. You know, obviously hugely influential, and I think Reed is a great songwriter, and the band is proto-punk, right? I mean, they are very primitive means to get across music that veers from the primitive to the challenging. But there are tracks on those albums, and certainly, you know, on White Light, White Heat, where I'm like, you know, as an experiment, I admire this, but it's music. It's not all that compelling to me. Some of it's really good. Some of the songs are really miraculous. And what? Are we going to argue Lou Reed wrote 2/3 of his best songs for them? At least half, right? You know, I mean, he wrote some fine stuff afterwards, but a lot of his very best stuff with them. And then I had not listened to this album probably for 20, 25 years. I listened to Talking Heads 77.
Oh, right.
Before they hook up with Eno, and I'd forgotten how much I like Pulled Up, where he's just freaking out and screaming.
Yeah.
You know? It's kind of a fun record. It's a guitar-centric record. I think the Eno collaborations are more compelling. I like Speaking in Tongues better. And after that, it's kind of the decline comes quickly. But, you know, it was interesting to go back to it because I had not listened to this record for so many years. Didn't have a digital copy and thought, you know, I should make one. So if you want to know where that band came from, I wouldn't start there necessarily, but there are a couple amazing performances. And the very end of the album is like Psycho Killer and Pulled Up. And it's like, okay, yes. Well, that's a pretty strong, yeah.
Those are good closers. I think I read somewhere that when they started, David Byrne, I don't know if he can now, but he couldn't read music.
Yeah.
And you know, learned to play guitar. Like, he does play guitar, but he learned, you know, he had to learn music later. Now, there's your DIY aesthetic right there, you know.
It's, and of course, the band in general, they were competent, but they're not God's gift to instrumentalists or anything.
No. The most talented is the quietest and probably least appreciated member, Jerry Harrison.
Right, yeah, he was in the, I think, Jonathan Richman's band or something. Anyway.
I think that's right, yeah.
If you grew up in our era, an important group, and I enjoyed listening to that again. And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 167. As always, you can reach us at mike@jazzbastard.com and pat@jazzbastard.com. You can drop us a line on Facebook, or if you like, look me up on All About Jazz. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com, from Apple Podcasts, from Stitcher, from Mixcloud, and can be streamed from time to time on All About Jazz. Tune in next time as we discuss work by Gary McFarland, Eric Hoffbauer, Wolfgang Hafner, and Grace Kelly. Until next time, take care.